good evening and happy Shabbat to everyone. I am Craig. Here, I think that's Kirk. That is your area code up there, correct?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Good, good to have you. We're down.
I can barely hear you a little bit. You seem like you're in an echo or something.
Hang on 1 second. All right, maybe that's a little better.
That's great. Perfect.
Okay. I think we just now have Larry calling in. We are down there.
Yeah, I was showing up a little late here, pal. Matt and I was talking. Apparently there's some people confused that think that somehow or another there's some new movement that's starting the new year on the vernal equinox. They think they're involved in the Iranian new year called Nowruz instead of looking at the moon. Matt just wanted me to explain that, we don't do sun worship here. It's actually counted, the new year based on the renewing of the light of the moon, not on the sun,
right.
The vernal equinox. We're not right. Into sun worship here.
And the first month is always in the spring. It is Abib. It is when the barley kernels are still green and growing and therefore receptive. And the flax is flowering with its blue flower. And so the first month is Abib. It is defined by the word that God picked to describe it. And therefore we know that the first month is the renewing of the light across the surface of the moon in the closest to the beginning of spring. Now, let's before we get into to that, because I do want to talk about what I think is the timing. Well, no, I'm going to rephrase that. I'm going to share when I'm going to celebrate Pesach. I'm not going to share when I think is the right timing for Pesach, because I don't want to be presumptive in that regard. I'm just going to share my reasoning on this. But before we do, we are one man down. James is celebrating the birth of his daughter he and his wife, Patty. Dylan is her name. She is absolutely adorable. He has sent pictures. I'm sure many of you have seen them of his daughter. I mean, she and most newborns don't look great, but boy, she is just as cute as she can be. Oh, she is absolutely lovely. Yep, she and Patty look great, and everybody is as absolutely as healthy as can possibly be, but they're experiencing, the beginning of their family, so we will not have JB with us this evening. The only thing that is a bit troubling, well, of course we miss JB's contribution, but we're celebrating the birth of his family today, but JB did write a marvelous expose on why those who elicit a calendar from Enoch are absolutely ignorant of what Enoch actually said. It's the dumbest book. It is the most inane attempt at divine revelation that you're ever going to read. It reads very much like the Quran. It is just abysmal. And so we are going to dispose with the timing that is derived from the calendar of Enoch. So about maybe a week or so ago, JB, who is now celebrating the birth of his daughter, sent me a note and said, "Yay, when are you going to be celebrating Pesach?" And the reason is that this year, the closest renewal of the light on the moon's surface, vis-a-vis the beginning of spring, and Abib is defined as a spring. This is it is a harvest festival with the firstborn, the first crop being barley, which is synonymous with saved souls. And the closest renewal of light on the moon's surface to March 20th, which is the beginning of spring, the vernal equinox, it kind of depends. If you're going to look at the absolute narrowest of definitions by an astronomical perspective, it's March 9th. Now, the problem with March 9th is that at sunset on March 9th, there will be a grand total of 0.5% of renewed light on the moon's surface. And at 1%, you can probably begin to say, all right, that would possibly be viewable. But at 0.5%, to me, that's an absolute new moon. And Yahweh's Kadosh, his term, means renewal. So I just personally, I think it's a little thin. Now, I have typically erred on the side if there's any renewal of light on the moon's surface prior to the sun setting, then I'm going to count it as that's the day. But 0.5% is a little thin for me. So I'm going to choose March 10th, where 4.1% renewed light is visible on the moon's surface. Now, if you choose March 9th, which is the astronomical date, the earlier of the two dates presented in a Mikra section of Yada Yah, you'd begin to celebrate Pesach on Tuesday the 22nd of this month. If you choose the date that I'm going to choose, and I'm not trying to sell it, I'm just shared with you my thought process, you'll begin to celebrate Pesach on Wednesday the 23rd. Now, that said, Hebkal, which uses a formula to ascertain the dates, Hebkal, and therefore the Jewish celebration of Pesach this year, will be based upon the renewal of the moon's light after the vernal equinox. Now, the problem with that is that if you choose the earlier one, then you are, let's say, if you choose the 10th, you're 10 days prior to the vernal equinox. If you choose April 8th, then you're 9 days after the beginning of spring. And so as I look at that, you know, that which one's closer, 10 or 19, 10's a lot closer than 19. But they're using the April 8th day as the beginning of the year, and therefore have chosen Thursday, April 21st. So for those of us who are going to celebrate this on the earlier of the two times, I think, Larry, you were among them.
I'm among the later. April 21st is probably when I'm going to be doing it, doing observational from here.
Okay, so you're going to use the Hebkal date, which is you're going to choose the new moon that is 19 days after. Yeah, 19 days after the beginning of spring.
Yeah.
Which, you know, anytime it's you're within, you know, 2 weeks, either way, it's close. And I don't have any issue with somebody choosing Wednesday or Thursday the 21st as the Hebkal does. That'll be consistent with what is called the Hebrew calendar. But as it relates to me, I'm going to choose the 10th of March as my beginning of my new month, and therefore Wednesday the 23rd will be the first night of Pesach for me. Now, one of the things that I happen to like about all of this is it means that I will be celebrating the week of Pesach Matzah Bukurim to overlap the pagan festival of Easter. And you might say, well, why would you care about that? Pesach is the one time, Pesach and Matzah is the one time where the path that I've chosen to follow to Yahweh is so demonstrably different than everyone else. So when everyone is having their Easter ham and their hot cross buns and all that sort of thing, and they want to go and do their Easter egg hunts, man, I'm saying that, man. No, first of all, I would never do it. But beyond all that, no, I'm celebrating Pesach. Not going to play pagan on you. And I just like it. That's the one holiday I really like to thumb my nose at. So it's an opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. All right, so Larry.
Well, I'm going to thumb my nose at it, too. I'm just going to watch it a little later. That's all. Yeah.
How about you, Kirk? Have you decided?
Well, we had already chosen our council classes for next week, so we're celebrating the early one.
Okay. All right. I think
I'm wrong, and if somebody can explain it to me, I can do it twice and pull a Hezekiah.
Yeah, that'll work too. He did that, and Yahweh thought it was a grand idea. JB, I think, is going with the later date because of the fact that he thinks that since it does have a harvest festival connotation, that the likelihood of the grain being Abib as of 10 days ago or 8 days ago was a little
not likely.
Yeah.
Well, JB and I are one.
You are one. I just wanted to say that it's two in that regard.
That's right.
So, anyway, yeah, and you know the good thing about all this is that this is a extraordinarily important day, and we're all friends and family, and so with the four that we're talking here together, we are choosing very different dates, and no one is upset with anybody. No one's trying to overshadow anybody. No one's trying to say, well, mine's right, yours is wrong. And no. And, you know, this idea, how can you believe that God would be, you know, so ambiguous? You know, there's a right day and a wrong day.
Well, I'm afraid he was ambiguous in that way. And this is for the purposes of understanding, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah, figure it out. Work it out.
Yep. You know, I just went through the most difficult translation I think I can yet recall. And,
really?
And the reason that I want to share it is, and it's not what we're going to be talking about tonight, but the reason I wanted to share it is because of the fact that I think that God actually intended to be ambiguous. And I think he does that because he wants us to have to think. And it happens to be in Proverbs 7. Proverbs 7 begins with Yahweh giving us some first-person advice regarding his Torah and the terms and conditions of his covenant. He's pretty consistent in that regard. And then he tells us we ought to be really careful about the whore. And he tells us where the whore looks, who the whore engages, who is likely to be tripped up by the whore, those who are unthinking, who are ignorant and irrational. And then and after about six statements regarding the whore, the proverb switches back to first person. Now, typically in a proverb, if it's first person speaker, it's Yahweh speaking to his children. But what he was saying, if it was Yahweh, was close, but not quite right. You know, it talked about fulfilling a sacrifice on a day. And, you know, first time I went through this and I translated these six verses in the whore's voice, because it just struck me as, no, what God is trying to do here, this is how the whore approaches those who are susceptible to religion. And then before I would even share it with anybody, I went back and said, no, it's first person speaker, it's got to be Yahweh. So I tried to render the translation in Yahweh's voice. And then I was going back and forth with Roy, and I just said, you know, I don't want to make this call. I'm going to present it both ways. And so I went through the first time, and I said, all right, I'm going to present it if it's in Yahweh's voice, but I'm going to tell you where the problems are. And, for example, in this particular proverb, the first one says that, you know, he had made the sacrifice on one particular day. Well, Yahweh didn't make a sacrifice. The path to him contains two sacrifices. And it doesn't take place in a day. Those two sacrifices take place over 2 days. I said, no, it's not like God to mistake what, you know, mistakenly present his plan. And it might be a little thin there, but that to me is a big deal. The big sacrifice is actually on matzah, it's not on Passover. But Satan trying to fool you into thinking that he is God created a religion that is focused entirely on the one day, which they call Good Friday, the day of the cross, right? Where their God died. It took place on one day. So it struck me, maybe this is the whore speaking. And it goes on to talk about things like making a bed. And one of the coverings on the bed, the textile, came from Egypt, from Mitzrayim. God, he's not going to have anything from Mitzrayim, and no chance. And so you're okay, you know, God's going to create a comfortable place for us, but it's not Mitzrayim. And then it talks about the this individual going to having his home, and in the midst of this, I said, wait a minute, you know. Yeah, when we're all in the seventh dimension with Yahweh, his home will be our home. But this particular person was misled. They were wayward. And so they couldn't call Yahweh's home, you know, their home. Anyway, so I went back through it. I presented it with all of the flaws in Yahweh's voice, and I went back through it and said, now, let me retranslate all of this now in the Hor's voice. And so this was a place where I think God was intentionally ambiguous. And I think he did it so that you'd really have to think your way through, because that's the whole concept of religion, is it's designed to be a counterfeit. It's designed to be really close to the truth, close enough that it's able to fool massive numbers of people, and worshiping Satan as if he were God. So I think there are things that are ambiguous. I think they're ambiguous by design. And I think that selecting the day that is Pesach is, in fact, ambiguous, because the last thing God wants is for somebody to say, you know, this is the doctrine, it's this day, all you have to do is eat these things on this day and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, this is what leads to religion, isn't it? Yeah.
Right.
Instead of being thoughtful, and it's for the purposes of understanding. I mean, that's what I know. So, you know, and I know timing's important to Yahweh, especially when it comes to his Yobel.
It is.
Like that. You know, that's what the whole Shabbat, the seventh day of rest, is about, is a foreshadowing of Sukkah, of that seventh day of rest, which has not arrived yet, but, you know.
Correct. And the way I look at it is that, Yahweh was perfect. His timing is absolutely perfect. He knows exactly what day will begin year 7,000 Yah. Now, I think I deduced it based upon what I can intel, but I'm here to tell you.
I think so.
I'm here to tell you that God is not expecting us to be perfect. The whole purpose of the Torah is to fix our imperfections. So, you know, I think that the best we can do is to do our best to understand who he is, what he's offering, and act accordingly. And that is the whole intent of it, because God wants to spend his eternity with people who are inquisitive, who are open-minded, who are willing to go where the words lead, and who aren't so full of themselves that they are convinced that they cannot be wrong. And, you know, I'm here to tell you, I can be wrong. And that's the reason why, you know, I'm not selling the day that I'm going to celebrate Pesach this year. I think a really valuable argument can be made for three different possible dates.
Works for me.
Yeah, it works for me. All right. What we had begun on observations earlier today, and I'm sure that recording is now posted, is we begun on Psalm 91. And I don't want to go over too much ground, but there is the last word in Psalm 91 that we did not cover. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read Psalm 91, and then we're just going to deal with the last word in the first sentence, and then move on. It reads, "He who dwells and habits and lives restored. He who approaches and remains. He who settles down and establishes his dwelling. He who camps out after being renewed. He who joins in a marriage covenant, in the sheltered covenant, within the protected place, which is carefully concealed from sight. Inside the refuge and haven, the safe harbor and sanctuary. Even the garment of the Eliyom, the Almighty, so as to be withdrawn, ascending to meet the light, and going up to visit the awe-inspiring while gaining status and splendor." All right, that's what is asked of us, is to go there. And here's the benefit, the promise. In the shadow and resulting image, in the likeness and resemblance, in the appearance as a copy of, as a duplicate or doppelganger, created in the light, in one less dimension, as a result of hovering over and being submerged in the protection, the successful empowerment, and the prosperity of the most extensive and powerful Mighty One, the most expansive, capable, and influential One, with the ability to cultivate, to nourish, and to bless life. He will continually abide, dwelling for an extended period of time, remaining during the night. He will lodge and live on an ongoing basis and thereby endure through the time of darkness, dwelling and remaining living through the dark hours preceding the arrival of the light. Now, the last word that I wanted to talk about, because it is a really unusual word. It is this last concept. Now, I do want to, I guess I should precede that. I'm going to begin with the second to last word, and that is Shaddai. And then once we do with Shaddai, we're going to deal with why this time has us go through the darkness before the arrival of the light. And it's interesting here that Shaddai, and you know, it's the challenge we have here is that Elyon and Shaddai are both translated most commonly Almighty. But what do you think the odds are that God chose two words for Almighty when El and All already mean Almighty? Why would He choose two entirely different words for Almighty?
Has to be a different shading.
Yeah, so that has to be a different shading. So what does Shaddai mean? It means to be eminently powerful and fully capable of completing and fulfilling beneficial promises associated with blessings and prosperity. Okay, now the second one we're going to be made in the image of. So we're going to be transformed to become eminently powerful and fully capable because God can fulfill His beneficial promises. It is from Shaddai, which means to expand and to be expansive. It describes one who possesses the ability to cultivate, to nourish, and to bless life. These are the characteristics we would naturally want to see in the Father of the Covenant. Now, what's interesting here is that the Shin Dalet root of Shaddai is wholly negative. It depicts, so that if you just look at Shad, it depicts destructive beasts and violent animals who pillage and plunder, ruinous demons, even devastating oppression perpetrated by a kept woman or concubine. So perhaps Shaddai, in Shaddai we see the hand, because that's the last letter, of God protecting those who seek to be with Him and who are engaged on His behalf from these destructive beasts, not falling victim, for example, to governments. The violent animals not being harmed by vicious men, the ruinous demons being kept safe of the influence of evil spirits, and the devastating and oppressive nature of the whore remaining unencumbered by religion. Beyond this, let's appreciate Shaddai's relationship with Shel, which is this idea of being made in the image of God. We are empowered by the most powerful, expanded by the most expansive and extensive, being made more capable by the most able and influential. Simply stated, we are being transformed to be more completely in the image of God Himself. So that's the promise. And I read it as that because it is in the image of God still, that we are going to be one less dimension between now and a time future. And I think that is the case because the next word isn't designed to take us all the way to our eternity. It's just to get us from here to the time that our mission is completed.
Yeah.
So this brings us to the final word of the opening statement in the Mizmor 91. Luin. Also written L-Y-N. Sometimes it's L-W-Y-N, sometimes it's L-Y-N. It is most directly translated, will abide during the night and will remain until morning. It conveys the idea of lodging in a place and dwelling with someone for an extended period of time during the darkest hours. So the notion of spending the night and enduring till morning is based upon the verb's commonality with leil, night and darkness, where there is an insufficient amount of light. Now, Lewin's initial deployments in the Torah reflect these relevant distinctions. In Bereshit 19:2, with Lot inviting Yah's spiritual messengers to spend the night in his home, but with them electing to endure the darkness in the street rather than accept Lot's rather perverted proposal, which included offering his daughters to them.
Sure. Yeah.
Then in Shemot 34:25, the sacrificial lamb of the Passover shall not be left until the morning. In other words, not endure the night. Kara 19:13, do not allow the defrauding of a neighbor or confiscating of the wages of a worker to abide with you throughout the night. Devarim 21:23, his body shall not remain during the night on the wooden pole. So there's just no getting around that this word means during the night, and that changes the entire concept of the benefit, because if there was no through the dark hours, through the night aspect of this, then there would be no reason to look at in the image of God being one less dimension. But if we're going to be one less dimension and we're going to be able to be protected and endure through the darkness, then what he's talking about is we're being protected while engaged in his mission in what right now is an extraordinarily dark world and going to get a lot darker over the these next years between now and 2033.
Every lookup's about travelers and lodging, inns and cottages, temporary places. They're not long term. So everything fits. I mean, that's not a stretch at all.
Yeah,
stay or
I
remain
think
through the night, lodge, remain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the night and darkness aspects are important because it defines a period of time which Yahweh is offering to protect his children. That is not to say that his protection will conclude after successfully enduring the time of darkness here on earth, but instead that this specific promise is for a specific time, with even better things to follow. Another telling usage of Lewin may be in Mizmor Psalm 35. It reads, "Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning." The night, therefore, is the time of relative darkness that temporarily exists on earth as a result of mankind's corruptions, all of which will be resolved by the joyous arrival of the light upon Yahweh's return. Lewin is deployed similarly in Yahshua Isaiah 1:21. It reads, you know, how does Zion, which is the signpost along the way, the faithful city, become a harlot? Now full of judgment and unrighteousness, abiding in it in the midst of the darkness, now even murderers. Now there's a dark time in Yisrael, as we know. That dark time will end with the arrival of the light. Then there's Mizmor Psalm 25:13. We read, his soul shall not dwell throughout the night at ease, and his seed shall inherit the land. This affirms that God is addressing a dark period of time here on earth in which his children will survive with relative ease so that they can inherit his promises and live with him in his land. Now, enhancing the nuances associated with the verb wings it was scribed in the very rare hitpotel stem in his opening statement that this conveys bringing about a state or condition of prolonged life, living on an ongoing basis, whereby the object, God, enjoys the resulting benefit when the subject, the listener and responder in this case, acts upon and with respect to himself or herself. Further, The imperfect conjugation presents the unfolding nature of this result, with light being enjoyed on an ongoing basis as a continual expression of volition. Therefore, our decision to act in accordance with this instruction not only invites the stated benefits for long life in Yahweh's image, our doing so pleases God, makes him happy. It's what he wants. Moreover, the benefits are ongoing, continuing to fold throughout time. So, if I put it all together, here's what it says. He who dwells inhabits and lives restored. He who approaches and remains. He who settles down and establishes his dwelling. He who camps out after being renewed. He who joins in a marriage covenant in the sheltered covering within the protected place, which is carefully concealed from sight. In the safe haven and safe harbor, the sanctuary, even the garment of Elyon, the Almighty. So as to be withdrawn and ascending to meet the light, and going up to visit the awe-inspiring while gaining status and splendor. In the shadow and resulting image, in the likeness and resemblance, in the appearance as a copy of, or as a duplicate, created by the light in one less dimension. As a result of hovering over and being submerged in the protection, the successful empowerment and prosperity of the most extensive and powerful one, the most expansive, capable, and influential one, the one who is able to cultivate, nourish, and bless life, he will continuously abide, dwelling for an extended period of time, remaining through the night. He will lodge and live on, in an ongoing basis, thereby endure through the time of darkness, dwelling and remaining living through the dark hours preceding the arrival of the light. There's only one part of this that I found a little bit troubling, and it, as I was walking after dinner back down to my study. What if Yahweh asked us to remain from the time of Teruah to the time of Yom Kippurim? Because he wanted someone to openly confront the lies of the Torahless one. He wanted someone to be a voice of reason, to speak for him during this time.
I thought he had some.
Well, he's got somewhere during that, yeah, and halfway through the period, he gets Elyon Enoch to do that.
Yeah.
Which you're talking about in that 3.5 year period
right,
prior to that.
Yeah.
You know, if Yahweh directed me to do that, you know, asked me to do it, I'd do it. Sure, I'd do it. And probably anybody here would do it if they were asked. You know, it wouldn't be a fun time.
No.
It would be a pretty rough time, and you know, you talk about you're hated now, you'd be truly hated, you know.
Yeah, you'd need every aspect of this promise.
Oh yeah.
Plus, you'd be watching people that you loved, their lives fall apart,
right.
People that aren't covenant. I mean, there's people that are not covenant that we love. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that made Dode sad, really.
Yeah, there's a couple of benefits of this. One is... I find it enjoyable. I know you guys do too. I find it enjoyable to confront the religious and the political. I think they are such slime that it's you know, working on behalf of Yahweh, communicating on his behalf. I find it fun. I think it's a positive experience. Second is there are those I care about who are absolutely going to be left behind, and it gives you an additional opportunity to speak to them. Third, it's fun to work with God. It's a cool job. You know, it's a great, it's the best gig going. So, you know, that also would be fun. And you would know that during this time, things would be so desperate that there would be a lot of people who would at least be willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could make a difference.
Well, it's going to be the last opportunity. I mean, that's it. I mean, because you get 3.5 years into it, you're taking the mark. I mean, really.
Yeah, and then you can't get back. It's over,
right? Yeah, then it's over. Then there's, you know, at the midpoint, there's no merit in it. There's no benefit from it. You know, then, but up to that point, there is some merit, and it would be interesting to live in a period where all these events are unfolding. Because I got to tell you that that liberated from this responsibility, I ain't gonna be here.
Yeah,
you know,
you know,
I'm gonna be out. I'm gonna be out supporting the universe. I'm not gonna be witnessing this mess.
I want to throw this in, too, and we've talked about this before.
you know, I mean, our perspective is that, you know, on Terua, Terua is, you know, probably sometime between now and the year 2026. Mm-hmm. However, we could be wrong about that. I mean, that is the unknown day for a reason. And it could be that, you know, we're right there for the 3.5 years, maybe.
Correct.
We don't know that. We how do we know that? We don't know that. So there you go. I don't think it would be 3.5 just because of the way Terua falls, but it would certainly, we could be here 3 years into the Great Calamity, as Yasha Yah called it or wrote it.
Yeah, yeah, I think into 2029 though, when you start having some real catastrophe starts hitting.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right up to that point, you know, we've said before, you know, you let your child walk near a fire, sure you will. Will you let them walk in? No, no, you won't. You know, so we could get pretty near that fire, actually.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. I think that is an absolute possibility, and I never had never thought about it until I was trying to deal with this this verb.
Well, I mean, it could just be the trumpets right there. I mean, you know, when he takes us, it seems to be, you know, he's taken us out of the time of the Great Calamity. But, boy, it's done in kind of a rushed way. You know what I mean? It's just boom.
And keep in mind that the tribulation is there's two aspects of it. Yep. There is a preliminary part, which ain't any fun. I mean, it's bad. And there's a really bad period in the last 3.5 years.
That's right.
So it's just something to think about. It's that's certainly a possibility. Now, you know, one of the things that kind of affirms this in a little way is that in Yasha Yah 17, when it's talking about the Magog war and the Israel being thin at the waist and the terrorist assault into Israel following Damascus's demise and the like, you know, it has the harvest after thinning Israel at the waist.
Yes, it does.
And you know, we read in Daniel that that 7 year period begins with the treaty that is reaffirmed with the world, which is, in all likelihood, the treaty that then
will thin Jacob at the waist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Take now, the West Bank away from Yisrael. Yeah.
Now, is there... That is the natural extrapolation of the treaty that is reaffirmed by many, is that that's what it will be. Now, it doesn't say that that's the treaty. Yasha Yah says Israel will be threatened at the waist, and so we can make that connection. And that connection is there to make. But, we don't...
Oh, yeah, he says they make us give that land up. They make us give up
right.
that land.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the world doing it. I mean, it's not even the leaders in Yisrael at that point. I mean, they've walked down a path that led to failure. That's for sure. And I don't think I'd want a guy in charge named Benjamin either. Okay.
No.
I mean, really. I mean, that's sign number one to me that he's not all that. Okay. But, and I think those signs are there for a reason. I mean, you know. But I think they're obviously forced and they don't want to give up the land, so they do have to give it up. He says, then he comes in and he's the one that, you know, gets the standing grain. And he points out it's standing grain. So these are living people. I mean,
right.
You know, these are living people that he's taking at that point.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's so few, he does say this, that the world isn't even aware of what happened. You know, so the
correct.
Christian rapture theory is really laughable.
Yeah.
You know, that...
Right.
Planes are falling out of skies and cars driving down the road. No driver.
Well, I'm in mine. It's going to fall out of the sky. Yeah, I'm flying mine, man. It's going to fall out of the sky.
Yeah, well, right. There might be one, and they'll just say, well, you know, he went down in a plane crash in the swamp, and nobody ever found him. You know,
nobody ever found him, yeah. He probably jumped out.
Yeah.
Now,
One quick question on the one last dimension that you were talking about in the passage you just read. Does that mean Yah's in the seventh dimension? Will we get to the seventh dimension, or will we operate all in the sixth dimension?
Sounds like he's saying he's hovering over us from a dimension above, and he's probably already diminished himself down in order to protect us on this planet, I would think. That's
is he talking about just where he is now versus where we are, or is he talking about later that we'll just be in the sixth dimension is our ultimate destination?
You know, I think, first of all,
I think it's the latter.
Let me preface it by saying this. TSEL and TSELEM, which means in the image. It is also the Hebrew word for shadow. And so when you think of a shadow, the shadow is a two-dimensional version of a three-dimensional object between it and the source of the light. And so I just naturally said, okay, it's one less dimension than the object that is casting light on it. And I viewed the light as either being Yahweh or his Torah, the set-apart spirit, and being one less dimension than Yahweh, his Torah, and the set-apart spirit, which would make us six dimensions. And I didn't have a problem with being six dimensions. It's not a bad thing, because it was six dimensions through the night, as opposed to six dimensions forever. I think we have to become seven-dimensional. And I go back to the story of Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse. The only way for Mickey Mouse to actually be in the presence of Walt Disney would be for Mickey Mouse to be brought to the third, to be 3D. And the fact that Mickey Mouse is 2D means that he cannot come into the presence of Walt. And because there is a dimensional difference between the two, Walt can't enter the 2D realm of Mickey either. So I think God has to and wants to make us seven-dimensional. I think that is.
But do you think that's what he's talking about here? I don't. But
no, I think all he's talking about here is making sure that we endure through the night by making us more like him and protecting us this way. So we're going to be in his image, and whether or not that means that we'll be more dimensionally like him, but still a dimension less than him. I think that's implied in this, but not necessarily six dimensional.
Okay.
But no, certainly not.
Where you got it. I was just trying to clear with the six.
We're not going to be seven dimensional in the darkness of this world.
Okay.
So, anyway, those are my thoughts.
No, I think you have to be seven to be with him, because he's there.
Yeah.
He can come down, but he's already done that. I don't see why he would want to be there.
But the only way he can diminish himself and enter this world is to set a portion of himself apart, like the set-apart spirit. But the set-apart spirit isn't all of Yahweh. We're going to be engaged with the entirety of Yahweh. Can't do that unless we become seven-dimensional. And while he can take a twice-diminished aspect of himself and take on physical form, that is so remote from his total nature that, and since he's already done that, there'd be no reason for...
Well, of course, upon the return, it's still a part of him coming. It's just in a non-diminished form.
Well, they have to go, because he's going to be with all those people that are left behind and that have chosen him. They'll still be human beings, right?
The entire of Yahweh did not go with Moshe into Mitzrayim, didn't follow the Israelites out of Mitzrayim, didn't blaze on the top of the mountain. And the entirety of Yahweh most certainly wasn't bodily on Yosha. So God can take a set apart and diminish an aspect of himself and engage in our world, but for us to spend time in his presence and for him to be undiminished, we're going to have to be seven-dimensional. When he comes back on Yom Kippurim, he is still coming back diminished. It's just a lot less diminished than he previously was. This time he's going to come back as light. But he has to be somewhat diminished, otherwise he could not you know, the entirety of
Hell on the planet is an example. But he said there will be no diminishment of his light.
In no diminishment words, of his light. It just won't be all of his light.
Right.
You know, his light can be pure and brilliant, but not be all of his light.
Exactly. So it's a part of him. Just with this, you know, before he was a part of him in diminished form. This time it'll just be a part of him, not in a diminished form.
Correct. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think so. All right. So then this continues to be part of that first statement. It says, "Who says?" So it's not just coming into the place where you're choosing to live with Yahweh, choosing to camp out with him. He says it's also one who says to approach Yahweh, "You are my trusted place of refuge. You are my stronghold, my God." The consistent one in whom I consistently trust and rely upon. So to receive these benefits, you're going to be one of those who says, who genuinely declares and continually communicates, to approach Yahweh, my trusted place of refuge and my stronghold. My God is steadfast, and he is the constant one. In him I consistently trust and actually rely. So this is this protected place is only available to those who know and use Yahweh's name and who choose to trust and rely on Yahweh and who view Yahweh as their source of strength, who know Yahweh as their God. They recognize Yahweh is steadfast and constant, unchanging, perpetual and yet dependable. And they've made the determination in him and him alone, they're going to continually and consistently trust and rely. Boy, it sounds a lot like the conditions of the covenant, doesn't it?
Yeah. The offer, the response.
Right. That, you know, in the conditions of the covenant, you need to walk away from depending and relying upon religion and politics, and you need to trust and rely on Yahweh instead. And then you need to walk to him and become perfect, because that is the proposal that he is offering. You know, recognizing that as your God, you become his children. And understanding that the terms and conditions of the covenant is what we're asked to observe. Why? Because they're reliable and dependable. So in him, I trust and rely. And, boy, it sounds like the conditions of the covenant. So if you're... This offer is being afforded to those who engage in the covenant, is how I read this. And that's Psalm 91:2.
Well, there's no other way to read it. You've got to be engaged there.
I mean, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, right. No, it's for everybody, because he loves everybody.
No,
it's kind of hard to pull out
of that. He's got a lot of people he hates.
Yeah. So, Yahweh is my trusted place of sanctuary. You know, there is, every time I write sanctuary, read sanctuary, I kind of want to scream that I know that religious churches use sanctuary to describe their most, you know, religious place. But a sanctuary is really just a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Right. I never looked at that word sanctuary as a religious term. Just never did. It's just a safe place.
I was looking, you know, originally when I negotiated with God, I was looking for a safe sanctuary. I wanted my home to be a safe sanctuary. And I didn't mean that in a religious way. I meant that in the definition of the word sanctuary. And so a safe harbor, if you will, from danger. You know, if you look up the synonyms, it is a refuge, a reserve, a reservation, a place where life is preserved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Langar Gah is how they would say that in Persian, by the way. Langar Gah.
Okay.
Just means safe haven, safe harbor,
safe,
really.
Safe harbor. Yeah, I was one time in my life a boater, and a safe harbor is something you you really look forward to. Surely, he will defend, extricate, and deliver you from the contrived plots and entrapment leading to being under the control of those who bait their traps to entice, luring in their prey, from the epidemic and deadly plague of written and spoken declarations, of destructive and malicious threats. Well, let me tell you that. Yeah, you know, I actually look at this as being, Jack, because I view it personally. You know, I view that while there isn't anything that God wrote that doesn't apply to all of us, I look at this as more narrowly just because of how important it was to me personally. I'm saying that, God does exactly the same thing that he promised he was going to do for me to all of us. Because I look at it personally, I see both Paul and Muhammad here. I see both Western governments and also Islamic terrorists.
I see a combination of religion and politics.
I see both.
Yeah, especially when we're Leodosia, you know.
Yeah. I finally got to the point where the primary reason, well, not the primary reason, but one of the reasons that I didn't want to do Shattering Myths anymore is that I realized that we're coming up in a time where the government is going to concoct fables, is going to manufacture lies regarding individuals to silence them and incarcerate them, to publicly humiliate them. And, there's a lot of living still to do. There's a lot of research and reading and sharing. And, I didn't want to be out there with the NSA and the CIA and the FBI. Everything I was doing with the intended purpose of incarcerating me, I would not do well incarcerated. And so, I really wanted to enjoy life. And for me, the big issue was that I wasn't translating anymore, I wasn't writing anymore, and I missed it.
Also on a network where every other commercial was a patriotic or a Biden.
I just said one of the reasons. It was one of the reasons, but that one reason was pertinent here. But yeah, absolutely, that drove me nuts.
I found it laughable. They were just laughable. Those commercials are just laughable.
Laughable. So surely he will defend, extricate, and deliver you. So should I be worried about being harassed by my government? No. Because he says, surely he will defend, extricate, and deliver you. Spare you and save you. Draw you out and take you away from. Rescue you by snatching you away. Now here with the Hiphil stem, the subject of God, enables the object, us, to participate in the action, which is being delivered from danger, while the imperfect denotes the ongoing and unfolding ramifications of being extricated from harm's way. And he's going to defend us and deliver us from the contrived plots and the entrapment leading to being under the control of those who bait their traps to entice, to lure in their prey. I think that's more than just religion. I do think it's government.
Combination of both. That's where we're at. The whole government system's a combination of all of it. I mean, when you look at the four beasts, you look at the final beast, right?
It's a combination of
all those empires and what they've learned to control people, all balled into one, I think.
Roman Catholicism, what you had is the beast of Babylon morphing into the beast of Persia, morphing into the beast of Greece, morphing into the beast of Imperial Rome, morphing into the Roman Catholic Church, being the worst of the beasts. And each of those beasts was a combination of political, religious, and militaristic. Mm-hmm. It was all of those things.
Well, you get all those things rolled into one. I mean, well, you know, I mean, we know that Catholicism, I mean, as a religion, it most closely mirrors, you know, the Babylonian religion of Lord Baal. I mean, we know that, you know, right down to Easter and Christmas and all the rest of it. You take the Persian Empire, and they were the first people to, Koresh was the first king to actually give government retirement benefits to government employees.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's been employed now, you know. Then we get the Greeks, right, and all that New Testament and Paul's letters and all that.
Right.
That's all in Greek, you know.
And their philosophies, yeah.
And you know, you look at all that. I mean, I was looking at it kind of that way because I happened to be looking at this exact subject this week. And they're all balled into one now. Under a Roman flag that just never never got rid of,
and that's the reason I think that Daniel's presented that way. I'm convinced that he told the story of Babylon to Persia to Greece to Rome to Roman Catholicism and therefore Christianity, and the beast association with Shaul. I think he told that story because. Babylon is the mother of the harlots. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
Babylon is the birthplace, and these are all of her children.
Yep.
That Persia was a result of Babylon, that Greece was a result of Babylon, that Rome was a result of Babylon, that Christianity is a result of Babylon. They all grew out of it. So it is this one beast that has had these five manifestations.
Yeah. Exactly, and you know they studied each other too. You know they did, and
sure.
And they incorporated parts of each other into their own, you know, beast's nature, if you will. Right? I mean,
that's right. Wrong.
Yeah, especially wrong. In fact, I was just dealing with a translation of the beginning of Yashaya, and it actually has. It says, woe to an errant, blameworthy, and sinful nation of Gentiles, severely stubborn and heavily laden with sin and the guilt associated with perverted distortions, the offspring of harmful and evil children who corrupt and destroy. And what God is saying is that, you know, that Persia was the evil offspring of Babylon. Babylon corrupted and destroyed, and as a result, the offspring of Babylon was Persia. And
yep.
The Persians were
Persia.
Corrupt and they were destructive, and the offspring of Persia was the their influence on
Greece.
Greece.
The
Greeks
were general. How quickly they adopted Egypt and Persia. When they divided it all up, they became Persia and Egypt.
Right.
Colonies.
By the way, it's interesting here, because we're talking about understanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This says, the first statement of Yahweh is a cow. It's one who looks and sees around him and views the world from the proper perspective. It's short. It can either be bull or oxen, or it's a person who is observant, is aware and recognizes the one who gave birth to him. So a cow recognizes the one who gave birth to him. And an ass, his lord. I just love that. God has fun. And an ass, a donkey, recognizes his lord, it's Baal.
You gotta love that. You gotta love that.
You gotta use the biblical ass now.
Oh, he's just saying he doesn't have a sense of humor. Yisrael does not know and remains unaware. My people have failed to consider the connection, and thus they do not understand.
That is so sad.
So, yeah, it's really...
It sort of makes the people in Yisrael asses.
It does. It does. But he used goy to describe what the nation had become. And by joy, they mean, you know, those who were estranged from him. And animalistic heathens, pagans. So he used goy to describe what they had become, and I just thought that the whole thing was fascinating. God definitely has.
Now, where were you at doing this translating? What were you translating when you?
Oh yeah, we're now on chapter 4 of because we've done chapter 1.
No, I know we are. We're talking about the bull and the ass and all this. Where were we?
Oh, yes, the opening that happens to be. I jumped ahead to 2 chapters. That's going to be.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
It's the beginning of chapter 6. Observations for a time. We're in chapter 4 now, and I'm about ready. We just shared the second verse of chapter 4. Chapter 5 is a derivative of the Proverbs 6 that it begins with is a derivative of William the Elevator Man. He sent it to me and says, "Can you help me? I want to understand who the whore is."
Okay, so we're going back to 7 now. Is that right?
So then I did Proverbs 6, and it was imperative that we needed to tackle what God had to say about religion and politics. So we did in the mm-hmm. second chapter. We did Samuel 7:3, where God provides a overall blanket indictment of the most Babylonian religions, which is Christianity. And then the third chapter was his in Samuel 1:8, his condemnation of governance and politics. And then from there, since he has now trashed religion and politics, and it was important to understand what's God's approach to those of us who accept the mission to follow his example in this regard. And so that's why we're now in Psalm 91. Because this is God's encouraging us, saying, "I'll work with you, I'll protect you, I'll support you, I'll empower you. I want you to engage in this and understand if you do, this is the way that we'll work together." So I thought that was the natural progression of things. And then the next chapter, chapter 5 of Observations for Our Time, is on Proverbs 7. Because Roy had said, "I think that 7 is a continuation of 6, and indeed it is. And in 7, he specifically associates the whore, who is Satan, mm-hmm. with Paul.
Yeah, he says Sheol. I commented on that last night. At the end of that, you were saying that, whether it's Sheol, who's in Sheol.
Yeah.
Which is
I added. I added what you... had to say.
What I threw over there.
It's
so obvious we're talking about he again. It's just like looking at Jabba Wolf where we're talking about, a guy with a, with a soul.
So after doing Proverbs 7 and chapter 5 of Observations for Our Time, I conclude that by putting all of Chabaouk 1 and 2 together so that we understand how serious God is in his condemnation of Shaul, the self-proclaimed Apostle Paul, and his religion.
Now, if I recall, in chapter 1, in chapter 1, didn't he say he'd bring the rock to debate this guy? Well, we all know who the rock was, the nickname.
Right.
It was Kephish.
Absolutely.
Shimon. I don't even see how people can deny this at this point. But, last night Jackie and I were having a discussion, and I just thought, she said, "Well, what do you think it is that separates, people that decide to be covenant and go into a form of understanding and get in the relationship and the dimensions and what this is all about?" And, after giving it a lot of thought, it gets right down to it. I think it's time investment.
Yes.
That's what I think it is.
Yeah, I think it's only two things. Are you willing to invest the time? Or are you willing to go where the words lead?
You got to do both. You can't invest the time and then argue with the words.
People do.
Supposedly they do, but they don't look at the words. They don't care about the words. I think there's people that they're into self-adulation. They're into being you know, they're self-aggrandizing and stuff like that. But, and you know, they're real good at having, you know, familiar verses roll off their tongues and promoting basic traditions. But I don't really think most of them know the words.
No, I think they're kind of the verses they want to fit their needs rather than what did God say.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy. You call it a marvelous job of taking something God said out of context and truncating it and twisting it and misrepresenting it to convey his message. So Hasatan did the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, there is a connection between Eden and Paul's conversion that is worth mentioning. I hinted at it in the fifth chapter. But Roy stated in an email to me that is even more explicit. When Satan came into the garden, when Yahweh let him in, he didn't come in as a snake. He didn't come in as a talking snake. That was the penalty going out, was being a serpent. He didn't come in as a snake. He came in as light. Came in beautiful, gorgeous, incredible. I'm sure he was extraordinarily eloquent in his speech. So he came in looking more beautiful than Adam and Chawa, more beautiful than anything in that creation, is stunning light. And so they would have had no reason other than he contradicted and twisted what Yahweh said to disbelieve. And when Satan met with Shaul on the way to Damascus, he didn't come as an ugly goat or horned satyr. It was light. It would have been a beautiful light show. And I'm sure he spoke eloquently.
Flashing
powerful.
Light.
Yeah, flashing light. So
it was interesting in that, in you know, when you were describing, when Yah was describing, you know, how the whore seduces you with these brilliant lights and flashy lights and in the best town squares and all this. I was thinking, you know, it really put me to mind of Christmas.
Really? Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Boy, that's just a perfect depiction of what goes on in societies, isn't it? I mean, they pull you in with all this warmth and love and light shows and that's what does it. And it gets them every time, at least the masses.
They used to use old stained glass, you know, before they had the electric lights. I mean, the light streaming through these things, all these beautiful pictures. I mean, speaking of that with Roy, let me ask you a quick question, because we were talking about that last week with him, and we were trying to determine, or he was trying to determine, you've got a choice here. You have the tree of good and evil, and you have the tree of life. Isn't that more like a metaphor? You're choosing the upright pole that's nourishing, the fruit is nourishing, or is that really what's going on there?
Oh, between the two trees and the garden. Yeah, it's so far afield from where we are right now. It's
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't want to go there. There's a reason that God told them not to eat from it. They were already perfect. They were immortal. The worst thing that could have happened to them is for them to try to avail themselves of the cure before they were in any way flawed. And so, you know, it's kind of the idea of partaking in a Pesach without matzah. You know, Pesach without matzah is the worst of all possible outcomes.
Yeah, eternal death, yeah.
Yeah, it's eternal death, eternal separation. So here's God. He's telling us that there's a epidemic and deadly plague of spoken declarations. And that could be Islam or Christianity, or it could be political correctness. It's an epidemic and deadly plague of written and spoken declarations. They are destructive and malicious threats. I received well over 1,000 death threats for having written Prophet of Doom. And yet, never ducked, never hid, and there was no reason to, because Yahweh will defend and deliver us from those who contrive plots to entrap and try to control. As we continue with the psalm, it says, with his wing, he will cover you, shielding you from attack, and clothe you in a way that promotes your approach and growth. Under his wings, the extremity of his garments, and in the corner, you will find rest. His reliable and dependable nature upon you is a large shield to keep you cool and collected. And his steadfast, consistent, firm, and assured reliability is a valuable defender. Now pause and reflect on this. So what is he saying here? The first word is with his wing. It's Ebra. It's a winged being. It's from Abar, which is the ability to take flight and soar upward, ascending to the heavens. Ebra is the feminine aspect of Yahweh's nature.
Like an eternal cover.
Yeah, you know, it,
bird wings.
Right. We're told that the Ruach is like a mother bird in Bereshit. Mm-hmm. Yosha yeah. speaks of wanting to take Jerusalem under his wing and protect Jerusalem as a mother bird would do her chicks. But a winged being would also be the Malach. So
yes,
Yahweh's winged beings that would be protecting of us could well be the Malach.
I'm pretty sure that's what that means there, to be honest with you.
I think so. Yeah. And he will cover you, shielding from your attack, and clothe you in a way that promotes your approach and growth. And this is a Chakak. It says he will directly and indirectly provide a suitable defense from attackers. A barricade that makes you inaccessible, forming the protective structure by weaving together the cloth and knitting the threads in the fabric to bring you together with him. The Hiphol imperfect. God is empowering those he is assisting such that they are participating in this relationship and so that the results are ongoing, unfolding throughout time. So with his winged beings, he's going to cover us. With his wing, if you will, he's going to shield us from attack, clothing us in a way that promotes our approach and growth. Under his wings, the extremity of his garment. Now, this is kanaf, which you really have some options on. It's wings in some places, and it's an extremity of a garden in other places, and in other places it's translated like, you know, in his corner. You know, Larry, you like fights, you know, and you have your corner and the opponent's corner, and so he also translates this as you know, in his corner, you will find rest, and that's where you go in a fight to rest between rounds. So, in his wings, under his wings, the extremity of his garments, or in his corner, you will find rest.
You know, in this case, and in his corner, if you think about it, you got the rest of the world out there. The corner is a pretty small area in a ring. You know.
Yes, it is. Yeah, but that's the safe sanctuary.
Yeah, sure.
In a fight, yeah. It's a safe sanctuary in a fight. His reliable and dependable nature upon you is a large shield. Now, this is really what's interesting. This is Sena. And you know, so many people just read that everything was a shield or, you know, but in this particular case, this shield is extremely large. It's designed, it's a very substantial covering that was particularly designed to keep the wearer cool in hot conditions. And, you know, when you think about all of the aggravated discussions that we've had to have with Christians and Muslims and Messianics and the like, God keeps us pretty cool and collected under the in the midst of those heated discussions. And
I'm laughing in most cases. I mean, it gets to a point now where I just, so what? You know what I realize is what we all realize. They know nothing. They know nothing. Yeah.
Right.
You know, 90% of the people that know Yahweh's name. They first of all put a U in there and take the light out of the name, the O. And I have to tell you that they just don't know much. They just, 90% of them, they know his name, now they're going to drag religion, his name into religion, which is just the worst of all possible situations, really. which is bad.
There's a type of character that comes to teachers that want to tell you what they know and don't really care to learn anything from you, but they engage with you pretty much so they can tell you what they know.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
That I see a lot of times, you know, that's I was searching the other day for what I had read from Ken a very, very, very long time ago, and it was Ken saw the fulfillment of the Numbers 5 prophecy with the tainted water under the temple as being a fulfillment in 1033 of the Numbers 5 for prophecy. Not that we
halfway through the Yovel.
Yeah, halfway through that the 40 Yovel. So it's not a something that would be significant. So I was really trying to verify what he said. And, you know, I searched, and I found a couple of references, one to an earthquake, and one, two non-credible writers that didn't have any substantiation that said, you know, the well, the Gishon well had become septic. And, you know, after spending 6 hours looking, I just gave up and said, okay, well, if it's that hard to find, it certainly isn't a fulfillment of something important from God's perspective. So I just said, you know, I'm just not gonna look anymore. But as I was searching, one thing I came across was scores of sites that had my translations.
Really?
You know, I didn't have the time to go and say, you know, what point were they making, but they were clearly my translations. And they were using, you know, Yahweh correctly, and they were using Mikre, and then, you know, the more I would search, the more
Mobium.
Yeah, the more sites I came to and they came up fairly high on the Google searches.
Wow.
It was interesting. And you know, I read enough of them to see that while they might have had an agenda one way or another, that for the most part, what they were communicating was consistent with what God had said.
Well, usually when you use his words in the most, you know, honest way, you'll get to where he's going.
you'll get to where he's going.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I wanted to thank you. There was an email, I think, Kirk, you may have been in on it. I just want to throw this out there, where somebody had said something about a modium. And Greg, you answered it. As I say, I really don't have any idea what a modium is, but...
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Oh, deal.
Where
do they get this stuff?
They were speaking of a Moedim, what they were trying to come up with, was this would be the. Yahweh uses the term Moed to describe his meetings.
Yeah, I understand that.
And
yeah,
he uses Mikra to describe his meetings, and the plural of Moed is Moedim, and the plural of Mikra is Mikre. And so this was just a really odd transliteration of Moed, as in meeting times. And
well, they write Modium. I've seen it 100 times on FB. They write Modium. They don't write Moed. Moed.
Yeah.
Moed,
and then with a YM after it. So Moedim would be...
No, they write Modium. They do. Yeah. I've seen them write it. Modium.
Yeah, well... That wouldn't be the proper Hebrew pronunciation
because
all the YM does is make the Moed plural. And you know, sometimes I will use Moed.
Usually it's Mikre.
Yeah, I use Mikre a lot more than Moed because Yahweh does. That's not... We should always keep in mind that the two titles work together. But Mikre includes meeting in the definition. And so Moed is a speaks of an appointed meeting time, and Mikra speaks of an invitation to be called out and to meet. And so, you know, I don't think you have to put the two of them together, and if you were to choose one of the two, then I default to Yahweh's choice, which is he uses Mikre more often from Mikra because it communicates a great deal more. It's not just an appointed meeting. It's an invitation to be called out and to meet with God for the purpose of reading and reciting his testimony, to be welcomed into his presence. Kara, the verb that underscores a mikra, is extraordinarily powerful and used throughout. So any time that somebody prefers moed and then makes it in the plural to describe Yahweh's invitations to be called out and meet, I'm already a little bit set on edge because they're looking for a specific time to meet as opposed to understanding that this is an invitation that's being offered by Yahweh for us to meet with him for a very specific purpose. So it's just my preference in that regard. So then if you want to try to understand what these particular words are, because there's this, you've got Ebra, and I was just curious. I just figured I'm going to try to understand every possible term here. Is this winged bean, what the other term for wings, which was kanaf, what these words meant. And so I thought, okay, before invest the time to contemplate the deepest potential implications of this promise, just on the very surface of it, it's empowering and it's emboldening. Yahweh is going to enable us, flawed as we are, to approach him, perfect as he is, by dressing us for success. He's going to bring us into his presence properly adorned in a garment of light, apparel comprised of his very nature. It will cause us to look like him, to rise up to him, to fly with him. In other words, when our mission here on earth concludes, we can look forward to a much brighter future. Now, the second portion of this promise is specific to the here and now, to the battles that we are invited and encouraged to wage in partnership with Yahweh. He is telling us that we can trust him. We can rely on him because he is trustworthy and dependable, steadfast and unchanging. Every instruction he has provided, every promise he has made remains valid. You know, it's just really simple. His word, therefore, is our defense. Larry, you are, this is kind of your wheelhouse here. Knowing what he has proclaimed and provided will keep us cool under fire, composed in the heat of battle, confident, and therefore bold. Yeah, it's right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, that's my bailiwick. There's no doubt about it. I think that that's part of what the dealing with the serpents, poisonous snakes and serpents, and all this is all about that Yahusha talked about. I can deal with them.
You already have the antivenom. It doesn't matter how
I do.
You already have the antivenom.
It doesn't matter a bit.
It's the Torah. Right. It doesn't matter a bit.
Yeah.
The second portion, while I was incapable of properly translating this 15 years ago on Teruah, some 15 years ago when I first heard this, you know, today I experience it all the time. This is precisely what God has enabled. And while that is, again, personal, so is every relationship. And Larry, as you found, if you want to enjoy the exact same benefits, engage doing what God wants done. Now, upon further reflection, we are confronted by a word which seems to convey three different thoughts. It is kanaf, a bird's wing, the extremity of a garment, and a special corner, where certain people are brought together and set apart. Or, as I suspect, does it convey all three ideas? Kanaf is used to describe the appendage of a bird used to facilitate flight, and thus speaks of a wing. A similar word appears in Akkadian, in Aramaic, and it is used to denote both speed and protection. And Hebrew nouns are defined by their verbal or actionable roots. With this in mind, the verbal root of kanaf, described Yikanaf, is used only once in Yashaya, Isaiah 30:20. Those Yahweh gave the bread of adversity and the water of affliction were removed and put into a corner, assembled there, and thrust aside, so that they could not be his teachers. Now this was done so that your eyes shall see your teachers, this is somewhat reminiscent of someone saying, I'm in your corner, while a rival would be found in the other corner. In Malachi 3:20, a prophecy regarding Yosha is foretold as the greater light of creation's fourth day, having the sun of righteousness rising from healing in his kanaf. Kanaf can be wings, corner, or hem of his garment.
Yeah,
I think it's hem of his garment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm equivocating because kanaf is appropriately translated corner of a garment, hem of a robe, or extremity of a shirt or skirt. We are reminded that Yosha proclaimed the fulfillment of this prediction when he said that by simply touching the hem of his robe, an individual had been healed.
There's a clue.
Can I point something out here real quick?
Sure.
We had somebody asking in UT today about the Yobel, about the arrival. They had thrown up some calendar from some religious outfit where they played, the women all had head coverings on and all this nonsense. But, they had the year as like 59, 68 or something. They were off by 20 years or 17 years. I can't remember. I looked at the calendar. I said, well, first of all, they're off by, how many every years? And she said, well, how'd you know that? And I said, well, that's a simple Yobel count. And the fourth day of creation, as Malachi just pointed out, in that fourth day, we'd see the light of Yahusha. So that's year 4,000, So
right.
Just got to add 40 Yobel to that. And from the time of the fulfillment, and you'll get to the year 2033.
What do they say to that? That's so straightforward.
They just didn't know. They weren't in a debate. They just really are new.
I think what you find is that about 90% of folks who have done the math see Yosha having fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim and Shavua in 33 CE. There are some that think it took place as early as 30, but
they're wrong.
Yeah, if you do the math from Daniel, and if you do it had to be Pesach dinner, had to be a Thursday evening,
mm-hmm.
for him to be the Pesach lamb on Friday, for matzah and the special Shabbat of matzah to fall on a natural Shabbat.
Right.
And for the first day of the week to be the fulfillment of firstborn children, the only way for that to have occurred is for it to be in what we would call for year 4,000 Yah to be in 33 CE.
Well, and there's a way to do that backwards too, isn't there? Yeah, which is one of the reasons, the rabbis have this as a sabbatical year, where the ground rests for seven, on the seventh year. Of course, they're off by right at 3 years. You couldn't get much worse than that. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, it's easier to work it backwards. But you also have the situation where you've got Apophis coming in April of 2029.
Halfway
through the tribulation period.
Right.
And then
right.
you've
got
also
the temple being the cornerstone of the temple being laid in 967 BCE. And so, that's exactly 1,000 years prior to that.
Yeah.
You've got
a red moon, you've got a blood moon coming in.
Right.
There's only one. That centers over Jerusalem.
On Sukkah.
33 CE, and
right.
it's the only year that Sukkah starts on a natural Shabbat, which is absolutely
correct.
Perfect timing.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, I worked it backwards from that angle instead of forwards,
right.
going back thousands of years like you did. But it was really because of stuff you had presented in different parts. But looking at it from backwards, that's what's perfect. It's perfect. But anyway.
Yeah, and my only comment always has been that I'm not perfect. And while I did the math and I studied the time of the decree and the 20th year of Artaxerxes and came up with 444 BCE. And if you use that to Take the 7 times 7 of years, and you extend the map using prophetic years. You have Yosha walking into Jerusalem on 4 days before Pesach, on a Monday of that year, 4 days prior to Pesach, so that he could serve as the Passover lamb. He says he's going to have Passover 4 days later, which would have been a Thursday night in 33 CE. And he was the Passover lamb on Friday, which was Passover in 33 CE. And so the Daniel prophecy fits it to the day. And the you've just got overwhelmed.
The Sukkah starting on a natural Shabbat has got to clinch it. I mean, come on,
right.
It's been a few years of either way. That's the only year.
Well,
it
happened. So, and well, so does matzah falls on a natural Shabbat in 33.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I just don't see how anybody gets around that, knowing how perfect the timing is. There's just no way around it. So it's 33. It's 2033, and it happened in 33 CE, right there on the year 4000, the fourth day.
I'm with you. I think that the apart from the fact that I don't ever want to be dogmatic, because I've made mistakes and I'm flawed, but boy, you come at it. It's 33 CE, and Yom Kippurim being October 2nd, 33 CE. That's the day of the return. So the thing that I would never tell you that I can be certain about, because it is Teruah. You know, I'm not here to tell you that Teruah has to. I mean, originally I thought that Teruah had to occur before the tribulation began, but. I'm not certain that's the case, particularly in reading Yeshaya 17 and now reading Psalm 91. You know, it's we could go through the first part of the tribulation, but not the great tribulation that begins halfway through. And it would be in our interest, it would be in Yahweh's interest, it'd be in the family's interest for that to occur. You know, it's not like we're being shortchanged.
No.
Eternity is a real long time. And if there's 1,000 of us that make it into this and can confront the adversary, then the family's going to be enlarged.
Yeah.
We're going to have a whole lot of happy people. So I'm personally.
Well, if one of them, I'd be happy.
Yeah, personally, I don't think it's the. So anyway, I don't want to be dogmatic on Teruah, but I think the rest
can
is pretty
be.
Clear.
Yeah, and that's
regardless. So.
I mean, let's be clear too. Teruah was called, the unknown day. That's the day that was called the unknown day. I mean, it's unknown. It's unknown. I mean, and there's no way for us to know that.
You know, I'm not positive that there's no way for us to know it. I think it's actually deducible. The notion that Yosha said that no one knows and no one will ever be able to know is just not true. I mean, that's not what he said. So I think it is knowable. And you know, with every day, with every translation, with every contemplation. Yeah, we learn more. We have another clue. We learn more. And so the last thing I would want is to know it all. You know, the whole fun is learning more.
But that was always called the unknown day. I just want to point that out.
But the people who called it the unknown day was the people that Yahweh was yanking their chain.
Well, that's true, too.
The people who called it the unknown day and were the rabbis. You know, the day that was unknown to Satan. Therefore, if it was the day that was unknown to Satan, it was the day that, if being unknown to him, he would not know that he should present the sins of the Jews to God, and so they were going to distract Satan. So that he wouldn't know that.
Oh, is that why they were calling it the unknown day?
Excuse me
for being here. I just didn't
know
that.
They didn't want Satan to know so that he wouldn't report. He wouldn't snitch on him.
Didn't report the bad news.
Yeah, so No, I came to the conclusion the first time through it that it was tongue in cheek, and he was just having a good time. And he said, you know, when is the harvest going to be? It's going to be the unknown day. And he's, you know, poking fun at the rabbi. And could that be the case? Yes. But when I took the time to compare Matanyah 24 to Zechariah, it became very clear to me that the what's called the Olivet Discourse in Matanyah 24 is really a paraphrase of Zechariah. And I say paraphrase because that is the style both of Moshe and Yahusha. There was no reason for Moshe or Yahusha, Moshe in the Devarim, which is in Moshe's voice, and the testimony of Yahusha when he's constantly quoting the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, since they could be read, there is no reason for him to quote them verbatim. What he and Moshe did is to convey them in a way that would resonate with the people, to convey the meaning and the message such that it would resonate, so people would understand what was being said. And so the Olivet Discourse is Yahusha using the framework of Zechariah and paraphrasing it to communicate effectively to his disciples without being so pedantic that he read it to them. And because Zechariah has the one essential day, the one and only day that is the essential day of the return, and that day is the day known to Yahweh, then you come to, oh, well, now he's talking about the day of his return, not the day of the harvest of Teruah, and the day that the essential day is Yom Kippur. So, personally, I think that's what it all conveys. But, you know, the last thing I want to do is pretend to be an expert on Greek, because I think that when you're dealing with anything you find in Matanyah, unless you can translate it back into Greek and then from understand it from Greek to Hebrew and then understand it in Hebrew and communicate it in English, you're on thin ice.
Good point. Probably go too far from the on the in the prophecy of Daniel, year 1 BCE and year 1 CE, that's the same year, right?
Year one is year one.
Going both
directions. Yeah, there is no year zero.
Yes,
so
I mean.
There's a year one BCE. Yeah, there's a year one BCE, and there is a year one CE, but there's no intervening time between them. There's not a year between them.
Okay.
Because there's no year zero.
Okay.
In the that's when you're dealing not with the calendar of Yah, but when you're dealing with the Roman Catholic calendar.
Yeah. Okay, I'm with you.
In the Roman Catholic calendar, you go from year 1 BCE to year 1 CE without having a year in between. So that is a serious problem with the calendar. And I don't know why they didn't understand the concept of zero. I guess they didn't want their God to be born in year zero, so they made it year one. I don't even know. And, of course, why would anybody in their right mind pick that, the alleged birthday, as in, you know, A, God wasn't born, and B, you know, for the next 30 years, he didn't contribute anything.
Right.
I mean, really, he didn't start his they walk into the synagogue and read from Yashayah about the fulfillment of the Yomel until he was 30, and then then he went from there to the what's called the Sermon on the Mount, the Instruction on the Mount, and so his contribution doesn't begin at year zero. Or even 2 BCE, the actual time. Now it begins in 3 years prior to 4000 Yah, or 3997. Yeah. 30 CE. So who knows why. You know, if you want to choose a time to, well, if you know Yahweh and you would start your calendar, you would start day, year zero at the point that Adam and Chawa were booted out of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, year 1,000 would be the flood, year 2,000 would be the affirmation of the covenant, year 3,000 would be the establishment of the temple on that same place, year 4,000 would be Yosha's fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bukkotim, and Shabuah, and year 6,000 would be his return, and year 7,000 is when he is going to make a new covenant. You know, it's pretty simple that it gives you that accounting right there in the first chapter of the first book.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, what did you take as year 5,000? I'm sorry, I was waiting
I don't
for that.
I didn't even mention it. I skipped
yeah,
right
because
over.
It's kind of hard to yeah, okay.
I couldn't find enough verification, credible verification, that it occurred. And it
yeah,
may
the
have
poisoning
occurred.
Under the temple with all the pilgrims dying and so forth.
Yeah, yes. I could not find it. I looked long and hard. And I even looked at the Yada Yada forum where others have looked. And there are two references, neither of which are particularly credible. What is known for certain is there was an earthquake in 1033. And that earthquake badly damaged Oska Mosque. And so there was an earthquake that whose epicenter was the Temple Mount in 1033. And that it is very plausible, and I think likely, that earthquake caused the Gishon Spring to be septic. And and therefore there was in fact a fulfillment of the Numbers 5
poisoning the word.
Test for infidelity. But so I think it is, I mean, because I'm not going back and changing the places where I've written about it. I think it is likely that it occurred, but I don't think, I mean, there does not appear to be evidence that thousands of people were killed or that that it is well documented in history. It just isn't. It's a real, real subtle thing. But it doesn't have to be profound in any way. It's not, you know, there is no 20 Yobel deal. It's just like there, other than the Burkle impact crater, there's really is no way to officially date the flood because the dating system that was used in the Torah of for the hundredth place was easily lost in the parchments. And so there are several places where the Masoretic and the Septuagint differ, and we don't have the accounting in the Dead Sea Scrolls where I think when you're dealing with the flood, and it's just the Burkle impact crater is so specific that you know, I think it is year 1,000, but you know, we don't have overwhelming proof. So anyway, I've got to run, and the reason I have to run is I have a very, very sick son in Texas, and he has just sent me a text and asked me to fly down to help him out in the morning. So I need to go prepare for travel.
All right, my friend, we appreciate you.
Well, thank you. I had a great time this evening, and Psalm 91 is a lot of fun.
Yes, sir.
So we'll return to this passage, and we'll drill down on all the various things that Kanaf can be, and I think that we'll find that it's all three of those things. It's under his wing, the corner or extremity of his garment, and being in his corner.
Yeah.
I think you can read it any one of those three ways, or all three of those ways, and it'll resonate. That's a part of it is, you know, the deeper you look, the closer you look, the more you find it. Yeah, that's all of those.
Yes,
all of those. All right, guys.
All right. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat. And, yeah, we'll be celebrating the next time we meet.
Next week.
Pesach, yeah. Pesach Moth and Bakota.
Okay. You will be.
I will be.
Yeah, well.
It'll be a little further down the road for me.
We'll give you a flavor how it's going this year.
That's okay. I'm with James, man. We're up against you guys this year.
Okay.
All right. See you.
Bye. James. Okay. See y'all later.
Bye.
Happy Shabbat, Larry.
Happy Shabbat. Bye.